In this hour, we will return to a topic that we have discussed before on the program. We'll be talking about global warming, but perhaps with a slightly different focus. The programs that we have done before mostly have focused on environmental impacts. Many scientists, of course, feel that those impacts could be considerable. The general consensus at this point as far as global warming is concerned is that over the last 100 years, the average temperature of the Earth has gone up 1 degree. The consensus seems to be that that is a result of, in large part, of human activity, particularly the burning of fossil fuels, which put carbon dioxide and other things into the atmosphere, which result in this thing we call the greenhouse effect, which has resulted in the temperature going up. There is concern among many scientists that that could continue, and if it does, would have rather profound impacts on the environment, including changes in patterns of plant growth, so that would have certainly have an effect on agriculture. Another result would be an increase in the sea level, which could indeed mean that we would lose some land that we have now. And also there is concern that another impact would be more extreme weather, so that could result in both severe storms and also drought. So all of these things are particular concerns. Now, we should also say that there are still, of course, some scientists who don't believe that all the data is in, that we don't really know what has caused the increase in temperature, and we really don't know whether or not it will continue. That's sort of one response. And another kind of response to the issue has come from industry and from economists who have argued that to change the way we do things, particularly to move away from the heavy reliance on fossil fuels for generating power and for getting us from place to place, if we did that, it would be devastating for the economy of this country and also would be crippling for some of the developing nations that perhaps don't pollute very much now but are certainly interested in developing their economies. And if we say that they can't pollute, then maybe they can't develop their economies, or at least it would be a problem. We'll be talking this morning with a guest from an environmental group, the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is based in Washington, D.C. We'll talk a little bit about this issue of the economics of global warming, and I think that he will make a counter-argument that, in fact, it would not damage severely the economy of the United States or make it impossible for developing nations to develop. The guest is Dr. Dan Lashoff. He is a senior scientist at the NRDC, where he specializes in energy policy and environmental science. He has written on many aspects of both energy policy and also global warming. He is currently a member of the Energy Research and Development Panel of the President's Committee of Advisors on Science and Technology. He's written a lot on this issue. Before going to work at the NRDC, he served on the staff of the Environmental Protection Agency, where he was the lead author and editor of the report to Congress titled Policy Options for Stabilizing Global Climate. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, you should certainly feel free to be a part of the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, which is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-WILL or 333-9455. And that toll-free line is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can join the conversation. We welcome your questions and comments. All we ask is that people be brief, so that we can accommodate as many different callers as would like to join us and kind of keep things moving along. So with that proviso, everyone's welcome to call. Dr. Lashoff.
Good morning.
Hi. Thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it. Maybe, again, we should, every time we talk about this issue, I feel that we have to go back to the basics in a sense. I mean, maybe we don't need to spend a lot of time, but to, again, touch base with what it is we feel that we can say with some confidence about the issue of global warming. There's not much disagreement about at least the data that show this as I mentioned, approximately 1 degree increase in average global temperature over the last 100 years. I guess the controversy, if there still is controversy, comes over two points. One being, is this a result of human activity? And the other being, are we going to expect that the temperature will continue to go up, and at what sort of pace?
I think we should start by backing up one step to put out additional information about which there is no controversy, and that is that human activities, particularly burning of coal and oil and to a lesser extent natural gas, are changing the Earth's atmosphere. The concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has increased from by about 25% over the last century, and there really is no controversy that that is a result primarily of burning coal and oil and other fossil fuels, and also to some extent from deforestation around the world. So we know we're changing the atmosphere. We know that carbon dioxide traps heat, and then we get to the question of, so it makes sense that as we're doing that, the Earth should warm up. That is what all the climate analysis and models suggest, and the projected warming is consistent with the observation. And the scientific community now has concluded that at least part of the observed warming is very likely due to this buildup of carbon dioxide pollution in the atmosphere, and that if we continue on this course, the buildup of these gases will continue and the Earth's climate will continue to change, and will, in fact, that change will start to accelerate in the decades ahead.
Well, I think that when we ask the question, what do we do about this, the obvious answer is that we need to do everything that we can to reduce the emissions of these particular gases, those things that we know are problematic. And I guess the major one is carbon dioxide, and it is a result of burning fossil fuels. It's coming out of the tailpipes of cars. It's coming out of the smokestacks of coal-burning power plants. And that what we should do is everything do what we can to reduce those emissions. The response, I think, from these industries, from the mining industry, from the electricity generating industry, from the people who make gasoline and the people who make automobiles, has been relatively uniform. And they have said that if you force us to do do what we can, whether that's making more fuel-efficient cars or look for other fuel sources, that it's going to be devastating to our industries. Either it's going to mean adopting technologies that are going to be extremely expensive, or it may, with the example of coal, it may mean shutting down mines and shutting down the industry. And all of that together will be extremely hard on the American economy.
Well, you're absolutely right. The coal oil industry and particularly the automobile manufacturers and others have done and are doing what they have traditionally done when faced with the prospect of environmental challenges. They've first denied that the problem was real. They've sort of given up that strategy as the evidence has continued to mount, and they're sort of pleased that this isn't really a problem, have not been heeded because of the overwhelming consensus of the scientific community that it is a problem. So now they've turned to their second line of defense, which is doing anything about it will be too expensive. And I'm convinced that just as in the past when they've said this about everything from acid rain to ozone-depleting chemicals to seat belts, catalytic converters, they've said, if you do this, it will bankrupt the economy and it won't work. They're saying that now, and they were wrong then, and they're wrong now. What we need to do is, as you say, introduce innovations in the way we produce and use energy, particularly in electric power production and in transportation. And there are a wide variety of new technologies that are either on the market or just short of being introduced to the market that can do that, that can do it very cost effectively, and that can do it with a variety of benefits beyond reducing greenhouse gases, but also reducing other types of pollution that that affect public health and the environment.
Let me just quickly reintroduce our guest for this hour. We're speaking with Dr. Daniel Lashoff. He's a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, where he specializes in energy policy and environmental science, and he has written extensively on many aspects of both energy policy and global warming. He's talking with us this morning by phone from Washington, where the organization is based, the NRDC. And if you have questions, comments, you can call us, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. One can certainly imagine building cars, for example, that either use gasoline more efficiently or use gasoline as a way of generating some other kind of power that powers the car, or in fact, going to cars that don't use gasoline at all. And maybe we can talk about that in a moment, but I'm interested particularly in going back to the issue of coal and whether or not it's really possible for us to continue to use coal the way that we have. Is that an industry, do you think, that where the clock is ticking and there's going to come to a point where we're just going to have to say we can't use that fuel? Or is indeed the possibility here for technology to intervene and make it possible for us to use it and mitigate the pollution problem that we've talked about?
Well, we certainly can't continue to use coal in the way we have been doing it so far. We have to, if we're going to use coal, use it differently, use it much more efficiently, and find ways of capturing the carbon dioxide that is produced when you burn coal. There are some technologies that could do that. They, at the moment, appear to be more expensive than other options for reducing CO2 emissions. But I think that if we have a clear requirement to reduce our emissions with flexibility on how to achieve those emissions, some of those technologies may come in. And that's, I think, the kind of program that the president has proposed to do. We'd like to see it happen sooner and with further reductions than he's proposed. But the basic approach of saying, you know, let's commit to reduce emissions and let industry and consumers and the market basically figure out the best way to do it, I think, is the right approach. So advanced coal technologies may play in that, but coal combustion is the dirtiest form of energy that we use, not just for CO2, where it produces about twice as much carbon dioxide per unit of, say, electricity as natural gas, but also produces sulfur dioxide emissions, which cause acid rain and particle pollution, contains substantial quantities of mercury, which pollute the Great Lakes in a very serious way, and also burning coal produces nitrogen oxide emissions that contribute to smog. So if we, for example, switch a share of our electricity production from coal to advanced modern natural gas, what are called natural gas combined cycle power plants that produce electricity both through steam and through gas turbines, which are very efficient, we can reduce CO2 emissions by 60% compared to current coal-based technology, eliminate mercury emissions, eliminate sulfur emissions, and also make dramatic reductions in nitrogen oxide emissions. So I think that's basically a good deal for the environment and a good deal for consumers. Does that mean that we're shutting down all the coal mines tomorrow? No. Nobody is talking about a precipitous program. We're talking about a phased approach where we gradually reduce these emissions over a period of years. In fact, in my view, we're talking about a program in the president's proposal that's too slow. But what he's put forward is reducing emissions gradually by the year 2010, essentially.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller and would welcome others into the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone calling from near Sullivan, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I think this is the first of your programs that on global warming that I've been able to catch, so I don't know who you've had on before. But I wonder if I could take a minute to make sure that the people who are listening are aware that Mr. Inge's introduction was, I think, much too confident about this issue. Now, I'm not a scientist, but there are some scientists who write in English, which is a language that I can read. On the matter of rising sea levels, there was an article in Science last February by a man at the Geophysical and Polar Research Center up at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, who says, it is difficult to see how climate warming, whether anthropogenic or natural, could trigger a collapse of the Western Antarctic ice sheet in the next century or two. Ice sheets take thousands of years to respond to changes in surface temperature. In the May issue of also in Science, a climate modeler from the Lawrence Livermore National Lab out in California says, quote, it's unfortunate that many people read the media hype before they read the chapter by which he's talking to part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that's got a lot of publicity. I think the caveats are there. We say quite clearly that few scientists would say the attribution issue was a done deal, that is, whether or not global warming, if it exists, can be attributed to human activity. And I think a lot of people would say that this 1 degree warming over the last 100 years took place during about the first half of that that period. And that's a very important qualification. And the headline on this article says, many scientists say it will be a decade before computer models can confidently link the warming to human activities. So if the point is, if you get your information from somewhere other than the network news, you're going to get quite a different take on this whole business. Okay, I'll hang up and listen if your guest has any comment on it.
Sure. Well, in fact, you needn't hang up if you might want to follow up. But I'm certainly the points are well taken, and I guess my feeling is that, you know, not being a scientist either, try to do what reading I can on the subject. Although I guess I would still come away with the feeling that while there certainly are scientists, reputable scientists, who question question the concept of global warming, question the data, question whether it is the result of human activity, and question whether or not it will continue, that there are more scientists who feel that it is a problem than there are scientists who feel that it's not. But, you know, I suppose that one shouldn't, I suppose, necessarily even say that that where there seems to be some consensus emerging, that doesn't necessarily mean that those people are right. How do you respond to the comment of the caller?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues that he raised, and his points are well taken. If the question is, do we know everything about the Earth's climate system, the answer is clearly no. If the question is, do we know enough about it and enough about what humans are doing to it to conclude that we need to take action to stem this problem, then I think the answer is yes, and I think most scientists agree that it's yes. In fact, a recent statement signed by about 1,500 scientists around the world, National Academy members, almost 100 Nobel Prize winners, reach exactly that conclusion, that we know enough to take urgent action to reduce emissions of these gases that are polluting the atmosphere. The two specific points, have we totally settled the attribution issue, that is, the 1 degree warming that we've observed. Are we 100% sure that it is due to human pollution of the atmosphere? No, we're not 100% sure. The scientific community that's looked at this carefully, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which has been asked by governments around the world, yes, that the caller referred to, looked at this and concluded that the balance of evidence suggests that it is very likely due to the pollution that's already in the atmosphere. And, you know, scientists are a cautious lot, and so they're not prepared to say they're absolutely certain, but they believe that it's very likely. and that, but we do know for sure that the pollution levels in the atmosphere are increasing and will continue to increase unless we reduce emissions, and we know that those pollutants trap heat. So the expectation that the warming will continue to accelerate is held even more firmly than the conclusion that the warming we've already observed is due to pollution. So I think that's an important point. The other comment that he made was about one particular aspect of sea level rise, and will the West Antarctic ice sheet collapse in the next century? That possibility, which scientists have been worried about for some time, has never been something that scientists have said is a likely outcome over the short term. If the West Antarctic ice sheet were to collapse, sea levels would rise by about 30 feet. The projections that we most often talk about don't assume that the West Antarctic ice sheet will collapse. They assume other processes, the melting of mountain glaciers and some ice in Greenland and the actual expansion of seawater with heating, project that sea level will rise by probably 2 to 3 feet over the next 100 years, assuming the West Antarctic ice sheet stays there. But the fact that there is some possibility, that's kind of a high-end risk, and nobody said that it's likely, but it is something that I think one should take into account.
I hope that gets at the comments of the caller. If he would like to follow up, he's certainly welcome to call back, and anybody is welcome to call with questions, comments. Let me introduce once again our guest for this part of Focus. We're speaking with Daniel Lashoff. He's a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council based in Washington, D.C., where he specializes in energy policy and environmental science. He has written both on many aspects of energy policy and also on global warming. He is currently a member of the Energy Research and Development Panel of the President's Committee of Advisors on Science and Technology. Also, before that, he served on the presidentially appointed Federal Advisory Committee on Options for Reducing Greenhouse Gas Emissions from Personal Motor Vehicles. Before going to work at the NRDC, he served on the staff of the Environmental Protection Agency, where he was the lead author and editor of the report to Congress, Policy Options for Stabilizing Global Climate. Comments and questions here are welcome. Let me give you our numbers once again. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. I wanted to mention or get your reaction to something, and I hope this won't again seem like people will think I'm boosting a particular point of view or perspective on this, but I was, I guess, struck by back in August, in the early part of August, the head of British Petroleum, which is the world's third largest oil company, made a speech in which he said that he and the company believes that there's now enough evidence to warrant concern about the issue of global warming and the impact of burning of fossil fuels on the ecology, the climate of the Earth, and has said basically the time to think about doing something is not later but sooner, and that this was a major break with really the rest of the industry, and I wonder if that indicates some kind of change in the way people in the energy industry, particularly in the fossil fuel industry, are thinking about this.
Well, I think it was a very important development, and as you say, British Petroleum is a major company internationally and actually quite common in the U.S. As well, and their conclusion that it is time to take action, I think, has been influential. It unfortunately hasn't been influential with the rest of the U.S. oil industry, which is continuing to run a multi-million dollar campaign to try to prevent action to combat the global warming problem with TV ads that many people may have seen and newspaper advertisements on a regular basis calling into question whether we should do anything or whether we should do anything unless developing countries are prepared to move at exactly the same time that we are in terms of limiting their emissions. Unfortunately, the integrity that the British Petroleum Company brought to this issue was not shared by the rest of the industry. In fact, Exxon, which has been one of the leading companies campaigning against action on global warming and making the argument that the U.S. shouldn't take action unless developing countries like China take action at the same time. At the same time, just a couple weeks ago, the head of Exxon went to China and said, well, we urge China and other developing countries to join with Exxon to resist any commitments to limit their emissions. So they're playing a very two-faced game here, really just designed to undermine any kind of rational approach to this problem.
We talked a little bit earlier about approaching this problem by doing what we can to reduce the release of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, particularly carbon dioxide. We talked a little bit about coal. What if you look in terms of starting with what are the easiest things that we could do and move on to what are the more difficult things, can you sort of give a few examples?
Well, I think we can. Our probably easiest place to make large reductions is from electric energy generation and use. We talked about the ability to switch from these very inefficient and dirty coal-fired power plants to modern natural gas plants, which produce only 40% as much pollution for each kilowatt hour of electricity. The other thing that we can do is be much more efficient about how we use electricity. We, for example, can use refrigerators that keep beer just as cold but use half as much electricity to do it. And that means we have to burn less fuel to begin with to make that electricity. Another area, again, in the electric sector is cogeneration of useful electricity and heat. It's a fact that of all the fuel that's burned to produce electricity in the U.S., about two-thirds of it just goes into the air as waste heat. That amount of waste heat, just the waste heat in U.S. power plants, is more energy than is used in all of Africa and all of India combined. So there's a huge amount of energy there, and if you can capture that heat to do useful things, such as industrial process heating or district heating of buildings, universities, for example, and that's one place where this technique is used, but it can be used much more widely, then you can get much more useful energy out of the same original fuel, and that means you're producing less pollution and still getting what people want out of the energy that they use.
What about the area of personal transportation?
Well, I think transportation is the other key area that we have to look at. And there, the biggest opportunities are new technologies that can be put into vehicles so that they go further on each gallon of gasoline. And there are a variety of different approaches, some incremental that can make a 20 or 30% improvement in fuel efficiency by better design of engines and lighter weight materials, more aerodynamics. Those can make probably a 40% improvement if you put them all together in vehicles that look basically like cars do now, but just go further on each gallon of gas. And then there's more breakthrough types of technologies that have been talked about recently, such as fuel cells to replace internal combustion engines, where although you would still use either gasoline or some other fuel, the actual drivetrain would not be the mechanical drivetrain that current vehicles have, but actually electric drive. So there'd actually be electric motors at each wheel, but the electricity would be generated on the vehicle itself through a fuel cell. And that system is much more efficient, at least double, perhaps triple the efficiency of current vehicles.
We're talking a little bit before about the issue of cost and economic impact. Has anybody been able to figure out what it would cost if indeed we did all these things, some of these things that we've talked about, you know, build new power plants, replace our refrigerators, and design and build new cars. And we're talking about some quite a significant investment first in research and then in building new devices, and then some of it comes down to people like you and me who are going to have to go out and buy the new cars and the refrigerators and whatever. What is it going to cost?
Well, as you might expect, the estimates are all over the map on that, with industry claiming that it will be incredibly expensive and hurt the economy. But I think most credible analyses show that we can make substantial reductions in our emissions in ways that actually will be good for the economy in the long run. In fact, a statement to that effect was signed by over 2,000 economists this spring. The Department of Energy did a study conducted by five laboratories around the country that shows that the U.S. could reduce its emissions back to 1990 levels by 2010 with technologies that would pay for themselves through the lower energy costs over the life of the equipment. And that's the kind of target that President Clinton has put forward. We believe you can go further than that. Our analysis shows that we could make about a 10% reduction by 2010, again, with technologies that, while it costs more to purchase up front for the more efficient equipment, would pay for itself through lower fuel bills over the life of the equipment. And there's the TELUS Institute that shows a 20% reduction is feasible with these kinds of technologies. So I think the answer is once you put in place clear requirements to reduce emissions, then the U.S. is very resourceful, and companies will find innovations which allow them to meet those targets in a very cost-effective way.
We have some other folks to bring into the conversation. Let's go on here to another caller. This is someone in Charleston, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I didn't expect to pick up so soon, but thanks. Well, you mentioned the petroleum industry's advertising campaign, and you mentioned their efforts to basically prevent any action to combat, you know, global warming and greenhouse gas emissions. You know, from what I've seen, that isn't, you know, the take I'm getting on their ad campaign. I don't think that their approach is to prevent any action. But then again, you mentioned this term questioning. I think that, you know, the petroleum industry is questioning you know, the findings and the studies with, you know, relation to greenhouse gases. And, you know, I think it's an industry that doesn't want to see such an issue go unquestioned, which I think is, you know, your attitude, you know, hey, here's our facts, here's, you know, what we see. We won't accept, you know, somebody questioning this issue. And hey, I don't want to downplay the seriousness of it. I agree that it is a extremely serious issue, but I just don't think you should put the petroleum industry in the forefront as being the bad guy and the adversary and somebody that's totally against this. And if you might comment a little bit on that, and then on something else, I'm real interested in compressed natural gas for vehicles and wondered how viable and important you think that role could play. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sure. I would never say that people should stop asking questions. Of course they should ask questions and they should look at the science. But I think it's important to recognize that this is an issue that has been studied, for decades in a sort of scientific basis, but intensively for the last 10 years. So it's not like a situation where we're kind of rushing to take action, which is what I think the oil industry is trying to suggest is occurring. So the public message from the oil industry and their colleagues in this campaign is let's take time, let's slow down, let's not rush into it, let's do it right. But it's clear to me from being on the ground in Washington and looking at what they're really doing behind the scenes that their goal is not to take a reasonable approach, but simply to stop any action. And I think that was made really clear by the incredible hypocrisy of Exxon, which is saying, you know, let's take this slow, let's be reasonable, let's make sure developing countries move at the same time, and then at the same time go to Beijing and urge the Chinese to work with Exxon to prevent any action for 20 years, which is what he said in his speech. Callers who are interested in looking into more details on that, there's quite a bit of information at NRDC's website at www.nrdc.org, including a link to the speech that the head of Exxon made to that effect. Again, I think the caller is right. People should look at the evidence. They should read the science themselves if they're so inclined. They should ask questions, but I'm convinced that the oil industry's goal here is not just to engage in a reasonable debate. You don't have a $13 million ad campaign that's really distorting the facts just to cause people to have a reasoned debate on the subject.
And the caller also was interested in anything you could say about compressed natural gas as a way of powering vehicles.
Right. That is one of the options for reducing pollution from cars and other vehicles. Compressed natural gas certainly works. It's used widely in some countries, and there are a limited number of vehicles in the U.S. running on compressed natural gas. It gets about a 20% reduction in CO2 emissions per mile driven in cars, and certainly reduces other pollution quite considerably. So I think it has a role to play. I personally think there are other technologies that are more promising. One is producing ethanol from crop wastes and other biomass, not from corn the way it's being done now, which is actually quite energy intensive, but with new technology that's being developed that would allow us to produce ethanol from waste and switchgrass and other perennial crops can reduce the greenhouse gas emissions effectively by 80% or more. So, again, I think that we need to move forward. Let's set clear requirements to reduce emissions, and a range of technologies will contribute. Compressed natural gas is likely to be one, but certainly not the only.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me introduce our guest one more time for anybody who has just tuned in here in the last little bit. We're speaking with Dr. Daniel Lashoff. He's a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C., where he specializes in energy policy and environmental science. Before that, he worked for the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, where he was the lead author and editor of Report to Congress, Policy Options for Stabilizing Global Climate. And he's written quite a bit on the subjects of energy policy and global warming. Questions are welcome. We'll get in as many people as we can. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we will go back here to Chicago, line one. Hello.
Thank you. It's ironic that in a state like California, where they're trying to seek the greatest amount of reduction in emissions from automobiles, that a company like Mercedes-Benz would suddenly say that discriminates against them. And they were able to circumvent this ruling to obtain less emissions by the simple fact of saying they were being discriminated against and can now continue to sell their gas-guzzling monster vehicles, but they're at least making some steps in introducing new technology for future vehicles, such as a combination engine, which is a fuel cell, or some hybrid with gasoline and electric, I understand. Then on the other hand, a company such as Ferrari, produced in Italy, I believe, says they're content to continue to produce the monster Ferrari gas guzzler, whereas they've also said in the same breath they can produce a vehicle that will go 150 miles on a gallon, but they're not ready to do so. How about that?
Yeah, and Mercedes is an interesting company because they have made a major investment in fuel cell technology to produce hybrid vehicles, which could, as I mentioned before, probably triple the fuel efficiency of a full range of vehicles, ranging from compact cars to luxury sedans. At the same time, they have taken various measures to try to avoid U.S. Standards for fuel efficiency, claiming that they only manufacture a limited fleet of vehicles, and so they shouldn't be subject to the same standards as others. And we've vigorously opposed that attempt by them to get out of U.S. Environmental standards.
Or if you can afford one, they'll simply say, well, you'll pay a little excise tax for your privilege of polluting or gas guzzling.
Yeah, there is a gas guzzler tax, which both Ferrari and Mercedes, some of their vehicles are subject to, and as you're right, the people who can afford those vehicles will go ahead and pay that tax and continue to produce pollution.
One more question on the matter of pollution licensing that is now a marketing item. What do you think about that, being able to, if you don't happen to pollute as much, you can sell your amount you haven't polluted to another person or industry so that they can pollute more. What do you think about this practice?
Well, I think the basic concept is that you put a cap on the total amount of pollution that can be released, and then you provide flexibility in the market as to who can make the reductions most cheaply. And if that's done right, I think it's a good approach. There's a lot of issues about
what the cap is.
Well, the key from our point of view is, as an environmental organization, is the cap tight enough? And if the cap is tight enough, then and you've got in place mechanisms to enforce it so that this trading of allowances isn't used as a way to circumvent the cap, then you can guarantee that you've achieved the environmental result at the least possible cost, and that's a good deal. We think that these allowances to pollute ought to be not permanently given to any one company based on what they might have polluted in the past, but distributed on some kind of a performance basis so that the initial distribution of allowances is based on how much electricity you produce, for example. But if you do that and you have a cap that is environmentally sound, then I think that's a good approach.
There's one other item that was just brought to my attention in the Monday New York Times. A person has developed a project called Global Information Locator Service, known as GILS, G-I-L-S, that is making global environmental data more accessible now, and might be something for you and others to look into as a way of searching worldwide for information on pollution and other environmental things. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go on to another Chicago caller, line number 4.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I want to make 2 points. One is for the person who questioned whether the power of the oil companies is such as to affect very greatly the global warming problem situation. And that is that years ago, Standard Oil of New Jersey, which is now Exxon, plus DuPont, which then controlled General Motors, and the U.S. Rubber Company got together and, in effect, destroyed the public transportation system. General Motors, in large part, by buying up a number of trolley systems and city public transportation systems, like in Washington, D.C. and out in California. And this, in large part, did in public transportation and forced everyone to convert to cars for their transportation modes. The other point I want to make is that what you're running into in large a considerable part of what of the problem is that this country is a nation of snobs. The automobile, if you don't have an automobile, you're nothing. This is one of the obstacles to the use of public transportation, and what is keeping and what is destroying public transportation if it isn't already destroyed. If you read Veblen, you can see some of that in his theory of conspicuous consumption, and apply that theory to the use of the purchase of automobiles, ownership of automobiles, and you might gain some insight into that. I thought possibly you and your guest might concentrate on this area in your battle to get some sort of a rational program.
Well, some comments, Dr. Lashoff?
Well, I would hope that within a few years it will be fashionable to have a ultra-high efficiency hybrid vehicle rather than these gas guzzlers that seem to be the rage at the moment. The status symbol now has become not only do you have to have a car, but it has to weigh about 3 tons and stand several feet off the ground and be able to go off roads, up mountainsides, even though 95% of the time people are just driving these through the streets. So that's a huge problem. That, in fact, because of this shift in the market to these massive sport utility vehicles over the last several years, they now represent almost 50% of new vehicle sales. The efficiency of new cars that are sold today is actually lower than the average efficiency of the vehicles in the fleet that they're replacing. So for the last couple of years, the average efficiency has been declining because these new vehicles actually burn more gas than the ones that they're replacing. That's a turnaround from the situation that had occurred during the 80s when each year the new vehicle fleet was replacing less efficient cars.
We are unfortunately almost out of time. My apologies to a couple of callers we can't take. Just real quick, I just want to have you talk for a minute or so about the meeting, international meeting scheduled next month in Kyoto, where representatives of various countries are supposed to get together and actually have some kind of agreement on reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases. What's going to happen?
Well, this is a major meeting scheduled at the beginning of December in Kyoto, Japan, where countries from around the world are supposed to reach agreement on binding limits on greenhouse gas pollution. President Clinton just a couple weeks ago announced the U.S. position going into these final negotiations, calling to reduce emissions back to 1990 levels by 2008 to 2012, averaged over that period. Most other countries around the world have said that that is too little, too late. The European Union, for example, has called for about a 15% reduction over the same period, and we at the Natural Resources Defense Council believe that substantial emission reductions starting by 2005 is what's needed to put the planet on a course to staving off the worst risks from global warming. So we'd like to see the U.S. Move towards the position that the Europeans have taken and reach an agreement that actually creates substantial reductions in these emissions over the next several years.
We will have to leave it at that. We want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Our guest, Dr. Daniel Lashoff, he's a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C., specializing in energy policy and environmental science.